are not there.
That's not really
the job.
That's
awesome.
Because he wants a job.
All right. Who's going to present this?
Good afternoon, everyone. So for the last session, we're going to cover operating environment and risks. And just a quick reminder of some of the challenges that Matt mentioned this morning, that basically we're trying to address the narrow view of operating environments where trends and factors, some of the important relevant ones, tend to be omitted. And there's also a lack of focus on reporting of risks. Either too many risks are reported with the relevant ones being obscured. And there's also many different approaches to identifying risks. So we're hoping that with the proposed guidance for the revised practice statement, we would help in addressing these challenges. So if we start with operating environment, we're similar to other content elements. We're not expecting to prescribe a list of what to include in terms of the discussion of the operating environment, but instead have a principles-based approach of what needs to be considered in identifying the trends and factors to discuss. So these would be those trends and factors that have affected the entity's performance and position during the period, or that could affect the entity in the future, either in the operation of its business model or the execution of its strategy, and again of its performance, position and progress. So the guidance is also distinguishing between the short and long term, by identifying those factors with an immediate effect and those which will take longer to crystallize, such as climate change. And these should be discussed whether they give rise to opportunity or risk. So this is the area where we're covering opportunities in our guidance. The proposals also include guidance on the application of materiality, emphasizing that management should consider the likelihood and magnitude of the trends and factors' potential impact on the prospects for cash flows. And we're also proposing a requirement that management provides information to help users evaluate the potential impact. So if we look at slide 10, we're also including some requirements or guidance. And when management uses external statistics or engagement and external feedback in monitoring those trends and factors, so such as market data and customer satisfaction, to make sure it's clear that what the information relates to and that users can make valid assumptions and interpretations of that information. So as we've done for the other content elements, in slide 11, we also explain how narrative coherence applies in describing the operating environment, so either by referring specifically to the other content elements. For risks, we have taken a similar principles-based approach, and we're not mentioning specific categories of risk. Sorry. And so again, to help practice move away from generic short-term focused risks. But instead, we're emphasizing the consideration of risks which are specific to the entity by referring to the sources of risk. So those arising from the operation of the business model or the resources and relationships it depends on, the selection and execution of its strategy, and the operating environment. We're also seeking to avoid using the word principle, but instead we're emphasizing that management should consider the likelihood and magnitude of the risks, potential impact on future cash flows. And if there are risks which the company feels it needs to disclose to meet legislative or regulatory requirements, these should then be identified separately. As we explain on slide 16, we're also proposing additional requirements on what to include on each risk. So mitigating actions should the risk crystallize, and not only explain how the risk is being managed. Information to help evaluate the potential impact of the risk on the entity's future cash flows. Identifying those risks which are interdependent, and also described changes to the risk, including changes to the likelihood of it happening and the magnitude of its potential impact. Again, on slide 17, we've given some examples of how narrative coherence applies. So moving on to the final questions for today. Do you agree with the staff's proposed approach to identifying information on trends and factors in the entity's operating environment? to be included in management commentary. Do you agree with the proposed requirements on including information about external statistics and external engagement and feedback when they are used to monitor those trends and factors? And do you agree with the proposed approach to identifying risks to be discussed in management commentary by considering where the risks are arising from, and the likelihood and magnitude of their potential impact? Do you agree with the proposed requirements for the information on risks to be provided in management commentary, as we've described in slide 16? And of course, if you do not agree with any of these proposals, we would appreciate if you could tell us why and what would you propose instead. Thank you.
Let's run.
I have a question and a comment. The question is, if we want entities to report on risks, a question in our environment when we devised our risk management and risk reporting that came up was, are you reporting risks net or gross? That is, before risk mitigation activity or after? Because if you think about especially likelihood and magnitude, this could all go on for ages before you then come, don't worry, under control. And the net effect of that is, but if you just start with a net effect, then obviously you don't really see the real magnitude. So there is an issue here that I suggest you probably dwell a little bit on as to whether gross or net. In Germany, I will confess, we couldn't decide. We give companies a choice. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I need to say, actually, is that before or after?
But if you have taken proper measures to contain a risk, you don't have risk anymore.
Well, but we are not talking about financial risk generally. So financial risk, probably that is the case, because you could actually hedge you against that. But if you have operational risk, there's always a likelihood that actually your hedge will be imperfect. So it is constant monitoring and adjustment and things like that.
I was just going to say, if you at least have a summary and include those risks,
yes.
So in a way, considering them gross and
that's
listing them,
well, that's
but
right.
then having the mitigation.
Well, I mean, in terms as to types of risk, certainly there has to be gross. It can't be net, really. But within each section, you again have a choice as to whether you want to report gross or net, so that is with or without risk mitigation. My personal view would be, actually, I would go for the gross route. I would first say, actually, what is the likely effect and what have we done, but to then also say, okay, what is the residual risk? And here, obviously, you need to concentrate, because otherwise, I mean, you're just cluttering your report. Mm-hmm. Now, the issue that I have, probably the likelihood and magnitude rather than principal risks, is there might be side effects, actually, if you go for likelihood and magnitude, especially if you're thinking about legal risk. Because you might just give people a hint which claims actually probably have more validity than others. So if you report on legal risks and take into account, well, these are the ones that have the highest likelihood and magnitude, then if I were the counterparty, I would say, thank you very much for acknowledging, yeah? So that's probably not what you really want to do. So there I actually see more appeal to the principle rather than likelihood and magnitude.
Would that not give the same issue, though?
Well, the question is, if I say it's the principle, then I still have, shall I say, some degree of freedom as to how I what makes me believe that these are principle. Is that because they have a high likelihood, but low magnitude? Do they have low likelihood but high magnitude? Do they have both? Certainly, the only thing I know is if there's neither likelihood nor magnitude, then certainly I wouldn't report on them.
Okay, so because we've sort of gone down the likelihood magnitude route because we felt it would give a more rigorous basis for determining whether a risk should be reported, and that would be a net consideration.
But
you're saying by doing that, we've created this.
Yeah, the question is that what sort of Boolean operator would you put in there? Is it really an AND, or is it an AND or is it an OR? So what is it?
But the assessment is whether it would shift the user's view of future cash flows, and that has to be a function of both likelihood and magnitude.
In the end, yes, but, I mean, we're not dealing with pure mathematics here.
No.
So, I mean, absent financial risk that really you can hedge effectively, all of the other things that we are talking here about, I think reputational risk, business risk, all sorts of things, are very difficult to actually quantify on a likelihood scale. You probably can say something about the cash amount that you're likely to that you might lose, but whether you're likely to lose or not is far more difficult to say. And as said, I mean, you can't hedge by just taking out another instrument. You probably have to engage in some other risk mitigation measures in order to contain the risk. So diversification, for instance, or...
And because we're asking for people to take account of likelihood and magnitude together, mm-hmm. rather than likelihood then magnitude, mm-hmm. does that help at all, or do you...
So that would mean if something has to be both likely and significant in terms of amount, right?
Considering both factors together, it would move a user's assessment.
Which we would say is significant or principal, but anyway... It's probably wordsmithing there. Maybe just have a look on it.
I was just about to say that's the one, sorry, jumping in there. That is the one area where I would give the prejudicial thing where, because particularly in litigation, this is why they will tend to say, we cannot estimate the liability or the time frame for this. And when we read that, we know they are saying that because if they say anything, it prejudices all of their case one way or the other. No. So although I said, actually, in general, I want this transparency, this is one of the key exceptions that I would give corporates on any type of litigation thing, less so like on the maybe a human capital part, but where there is something which would definitely, and that's where you can clearly see you would prejudice your position. So that's one part where you could clearly say that happens quite a lot, and that's quite accepted actually by investors. We will, you know, we try and find sort of ways around it and bucketing it on that. And so actually on that, I mean, that's kind of what we do. We will look at this whole list, and sometimes it's long and not unwieldy, and we will essentially say, well, not very likely, not very likely, not very likely, and tick them off. If management could help us to them where it isn't prejudicial, then that is helpful. So like, okay, yes, this is a theoretical possibility which you're covering your legal liabilities up by saying it, but really it's, you know, less than a 1 in 1,000 chance of happening, and the vast majority of ones, at least in, you know, in the K's that we see, normally fall under those. So that some sort of probability assessment is that where you don't give it, then actually in investor meetings is then we have your question on management, and that's where you do sometimes have a more involved question. So I don't know whether this will all necessarily come in to management commentary, because they may not want to reveal that. It might be an anchor where you know that there's further conversation to have. And I do think there is some sensitivity around that. So again, although there's transparency, there is a, on the prejudicial bit, by articulating too much where these things are, or even where weaknesses could be. And I do like this. So the other thing which always comes up, actually, again, in these conversations and not necessarily management commentary, falls under strategy risk or execution risk. So management teams are always the first to admit that, okay, there's quite a lot of, execution risk, and they say that. And then we dive in. It's like, well, what is the execution risk on this? And then you actually have quite an informed conversation. So the headline idea of execution risk isn't that useful for us? Every single organization has execution risk. You know, that's the heading. But then, so that's the boilerplate which tends to go in, and then the better management commentaries give you something, and then you have these extended conversations. But where execution risk is so crucial to the whole being of that company, then that rises up. And that even interests my fixed income friends, because if it's a sort of almost existential threat, it's like, if you don't execute on this, you might not be as viable as you thought, then it even comes into that on those. So I kind of think that's interesting. The strategy risk is out there. How far you put it into management commentary, I do wonder. It's a difficult balancing act. We obviously want more and enough anchor that we can go and get that. But there are elements where you reveal your hand or your weaknesses, which are or can be judicial. And sometimes you then couch it in the language of, you know, what the market is thinking or where consensus is and your comfort around ranges. They tend to start talking about those sort of languages to give themselves some sort of cover. Then the other one, just talking about that, is the two other bits are, one is your certainty for look through time. And how I mean that is, sometimes you can say, I feel fairly certain about the environment over the next 6 months, but into 2 or 3 years, my certainty of that really falls away, that company or industry specific. And so sometimes you look through on your order book is only 2 months, so you'll be saying that, it's this here. But really, I'm quite good after 2 months, month six, who knows, because of all of this. But then the flip side is certain true, like some long-term trends where you might have an argument, say, you know, the trends for obesity in the Western world, they'll go, you know what, I'm 95% certain that that trend is going to be there in 5 or 10 years. So you're talking about the risk for some of this long-term trend thing, and you're putting like probability and shifting around that. And the commentary around that can be quite useful, because it can be, okay, you know, they really believe this on this trend, but actually on this, which sounds to be the same sort of thing, they actually only have 6 months look through, and they're not putting any weight as to what would happen in year two, really, although in 6 months' time they might try and update us as to where they are there. So there's the different sorts of assessing the risks, whether it's strategic, long-term, short, operational, the probability, and then the strength of conviction about how you're articulating those risks. And those conversations do go on. How much gets articulated within management commentary, I think, is a balancing act.
So one might envisage a sort of discussion of look-through time for each feature in the operating environment that is identified.
That is considered material or, you know, not likely to... Or it could even be, you know, this is on trend, looks really good, but we've only got 6 months look-through. So, you know you have to check in 5 months' time, because the environment... We know the environment may well be changing on them because they've only got a certain amount of confidence. And that varies across, obviously, company and sector. And same with these long-term trends. You know, sometimes they say, oh, we're really certain on this technological change, or sometimes it's like, oh, it's our best guess, but it's moving so fast. In 2 years' time, that might be different. So some commentary about that is helpful.
Mark?
Yeah, thank you. I had a more general question or comment on reading through the risks, and that is kind of the link with the TCFD recommendations. It was a question, is there actually merit in maybe picking up some of the examples that are in the TCFD guidance to illustrate some of the points that are in here on operating environment? Because I think people will probably be asking about, you know, how management commentary links with other guidance that's out there. And I know that also the TCFD talks about risks and opportunities and analysis specifically to climate risk. And I was thinking maybe it is worth, not only here, but maybe also in other places, to pick up some of these examples.
Yeah, and the issue being that whilst perhaps we can see that management commentary would require a discussion of climate risk in very many situations, that may not be sufficiently evident from the sort of slightly more conceptual wording that we have. So back it up with illustration.
Deepa.
Thank you. 3 points on questions 1 to 3. The first one, on question one, I support the approach and the principles you have here on trends and factors. The one thing I would suggest is, it's a shame to lose the three bullets at the top completely, so perhaps they could be incorporated in the guidance that sits beneath the main principles, just to give people, prepare as a flavour of what you're expecting from this trends and factors disclosure. And then on the second question, it was just on the support having external statistics and external engagement metrics, but I think that needs to be considered in the wider context of what reporting you're expecting in terms of key performance measures, key metrics that management uses. Otherwise, you could have so many different metrics in the front end and not know which ones are the most important ones. And then finally, on point three, on risks. So I understand elimination of the term principal risks, but again, just to avoid the issue that we've seen in practice of laundry list of risk reporting, incorporating some sort of flavour of materiality. And I know IFRS standards already have a multitude of different descriptions, just emphasising that this doesn't mean you have 20 risks, it means a reasonable amount of risks.
Larissa.
Thank you. Two very quick points. I would generally have thought that there's no need to state the blatantly obvious, but I find that that is frequently not done. So on slide 8, there's a section about the application of materiality and that management teams need to explain. But it is emphasised that to identify information on trends and factors that is material, management should consider their likelihood and magnitude. I think it would be helpful if they specified what they consider to be material. Like, what made you decide? And then related to that, because I find this quite frequently, on slide 10, I really like the bulletin point A about using external statistics. You would think that they would be externally sourced. I find that is frequently not the case. So the source and the date. What I do find is that companies with very specific focus, so for example, the segment that they report, they need to make certain assumptions so that the data is not necessarily publicly available, which makes it very difficult for us to verify as analysts. If the data is not directly publicly available, I would urge that they say how they arrived at the assertion. And the classic one where I see this all the time is in relative market share. We believe we have 10% of the market, really. Where did you get that? Oh, no, through discussions. Not a valid. I have examples. I can show them to you. It's not a valid source. The other one, which in fairness we find, I find as well, and it's is that the regulatory data that you would get, that they would use on which to base their relative market shares, doesn't break it down to the level of granularity that they report. So they will say, for this segment, which is very good, for this segment, we believe we have X percent market share, but it is helpful to understand how they got there. I'll give you a great example of something that came up this week, was that the company is, their aspiration is to get 20% market share of X. But there's a very big but in that number, and that the market is actually relatively easily definable. The distribution channel is limited. So the distribution channel that they use has historically never had more than 40% market share. So even though only aspire to have 20% of the market, they're actually aspiring to have 50% of the distribution channel within that market. And that you go from having a very reasonable expectation to have a borderline unrealistic expectation of market share. And for years, this went unnoticed until, to his credit, a colleague of mine picked it up. As it was in his market. But that kind of, that level of granularity, I do think would be helpful.
So identification of constraints on...
Well, specificity on exactly which market you're talking about. And if the user of the financial statements can't pick up the commentary and go externally verify that, that you tell them what assumptions you made in making that statement.
Franz?
Just a few quick points. One, as I mentioned before, this seems to look at risks as being static, and risk, you know, risks are dynamic. You know, they change in significance. Well-supported, you know, things that are good to aspire to in here, but some of these are very abstract. You know, to quantify the impacts of greenhouse gas emissions in 20 years or whatever is going to be a very abstract number. Frankly, you look at our 2018 MD&A, annual MD&A, 103 pages, 31 pages of risk disclosure. And a big, big chunk of that is written by the lawyers. Because if that word is in there and they take you to court, look there on the bottom of page 102, fine print in the third paragraph, we're covered. But that's really, unfortunately, what drives a lot of your risk disclosure is to protect yourself legally.
And so can I ask him, I'll ask it in sort of general terms for the sector rather than sort of your specific case.
Sure.
Of the risks that are typically reported in the sector at the moment, how many of those risks do you think would fall within the definition we're proposing here to replace principal risks, and how many would fall into our sort of category of other risks required by law and regulation to be disclosed.
That's a very good question. I couldn't give you an appropriate answer.
Because I think what we're trying to get to is, sure, is whether we've succeeded in sort of narrowing the focus of that field with the approach we've taken here, because that's sort of what we're trying to do.
Yeah. We have literally dozens of people involved in creating that disclosure, and everybody's, my risk is the most important. So it's a difficult thing. But I would take that back because I think that's a fair question. You mentioned TCFD stuff, and we've, yep, actually thought very consciously about how we're going to deal that disclosure up. We're not going to deal it up in the management commentary or MD&A. We have in Canada annual information form, which is equivalent to 10K in the US, and that's where we'll do it, because it would be very voluminous if you went through and did all the boxes on that, a lot of volume. So,
okay.
So that's sort of a 3-year project for us. But
Michael,
yeah, on slide 10, you know, I do look at the various kind of requirements there, and you know, I'm supportive of the intention, but I'm just wondering if it can be stated in a more simplified way. And, you know, I mean, I think we talked about how things shouldn't be overly biased and, you know, information shouldn't be misleading. I just don't know if all of these requirements are necessary. You know, and I'm, you know, I've listened to Larissa, and I don't know if it is necessary there to specifically require management to tick all the boxes on all of these.
When you say all the boxes on all of these, what's all?
Source all of information, these, date to which the information relates, the part of the business activity segment or financial statements, or this thing about external engagement and feedback, the various requirements, its items, little Roman numeral 1, 2, 3, and 4 on slide 10. I mean, and I guess, Larissa, in your experience as an analyst, I mean, do you feel like companies just kind of pull this stuff out of a hat and then they don't really describe or support it?
I find that the good ones, typically you'd find this information in the analyst presentation packs on the day.
Yeah.
In the slides.
Yeah.
Every slide should have a source at the bottom that you won't believe, but a lot of them actually don't, or the source is so vague that that you can't tell. And then what I'll do is I'll go pull the source. And you when you pull the data and you look at the assertion made, there's no way that you can verify the data. So for every single thing, no. But a lot of the stuff I find, if it's in a chart or a table, it needs a source anyway. Just specify it. And then if you can't link it directly, because we are trying to be concise. So for every little thing, no, don't care. But for big things that drives an investment case, if you're going to make assertions, so that one about we aspire to have 20% market share, that's a big one. Because if you pull the regulatory data, it looks like they can quadruple their size. So you think, oh, they have plenty of growth. And then when you start asking the right questions, you actually realize that if it's the 20% of the 40%, they're there already. There's no growth left. That, to me, is a fundamental assertion that they made.
Yeah.
So I don't think there's any way to get away from judgment. But if it's... Frankly, in this case, it's half of revenue. It was rather important.
Anyways, I think if this could be said in a more simplified way, I would like it. I think it can be done in a more simplified way and still get the same points across.
Because I think the fundamental point is we're trying to protect from the risk of overgeneralization if just something is not presented in a precise way. So if we would explore simplifying along those lines, would that address your question?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that would do it, Matt.
So I can add one thing. I actually think that simplification, along with specificity, will solve the whole problem.
Yeah.
You don't want many pages of explaining every single thing, but often it's a word or two that does it.
The other point I want to make is it's on slide 16.
Chadwick
has left the conference.
And we talked about provide information necessary for users' assessment of the potential impact of a risk on the prospects for future net cash inflows to the entity. And I guess I'm not totally sure what we mean by that. You know, are we talking about sensitivity analysis? I mean, are we going to say, okay, we've identified the main risks and there's 10 main risks. And, you know, under scenario A, B, C, we have a baseline scenario, which is, you know, things are good. We have a negative and we have a positive scenario. And if it's negative, net cash inflows go down by 10%. If it's positive, they go up by 20%. And you know, what is the attention here? Because, again, I'm cognizant of how much information is this going to generate? How much of that is going to be kind of a boilerplate, a la risk factors from SEC reporting, where you throw every possible risk into, you know, this very boilerplate type of presentation. And it's designed that way. It's designed to give you the most horrible picture possible. But, you know, a lot of that is tail risk. It's tail. You know, it's not going to be overly relevant. So, you know, I think we're saying here, we want you to focus on the things that are relevant. So the question is, what is the expectation that we're giving to the preparer in terms of assessing how do they communicate the potential impacts of these risks on future net cash inflows? I mean, is it qualitative, which is kind of the way I think about it, or is this really translating into a quantitative approach where you start having baseline scenarios and up and down scenarios, which I think analysts would probably say, yeah, I want a baseline scenario and I want ups and downs because that's going to help me in my modeling. But I don't think that's our intention. So just some clarity.
Okay. So clarifying that one, I think perhaps what we should have emphasized there was eyes of management, because we're not seeking to ask management to create new information or to pull new information that they're not using to run the business. So there may well be cases where they have quantitative information that would allow a user to assess an impact over a range of scenarios, in which case, if it's material, we wouldn't want them to sit on it. Equally, there may be scenarios or situations where management doesn't feel it needs that information to run the business, and perhaps it can sort of run the business more on feel than on quantitative factors, in which case we're asking for the scenario to be explained but passing it over to the user to interpret that scenario. Vincent?
I had a question on the interdependent risks. I was really trying to get as to what your objectives were around this. Is the objective really to give a sense of the narrative coherence? Is it more around giving a sense of the risk aggregation and potential offsetting? And in that regard, I was wondering if the objective is the latter, why you'd only pick on the interdependent risks? Should you also consider risks if they're correlated, not just interdependent?
Well, that's a good question in terms of the distinction between correlated and interdependent. One of the reasons we felt that requirement would be particularly useful is in the context of the funding strategy discussion, because one might envisage a scenario where the entity felt that it needed to allow funding headroom for maybe one or two isolated risks, but actually there's a strong correlation between groups of risks, and therefore the assessment of a user's assessment of funding strategy would depend on knowing that those risks were correlated and perhaps having some insight into the extent to which they're correlated.
Chris? Oh, sorry. Vincent, did you... you had your... Chris, no?
So just a couple of quick comments. So the first one was just in terms of the operating environment. We had a suggestion that you might want to give some categories into which people could break those down. And so the categories that we're seeing used a bit at the moment are the mega trends, which is the climate risk and the population risk, macro risks, which the UK people will go Brexit and currency type stuff, and then the direct operating environment, which ties in with what your specific circumstances are. So just also reflecting that earlier this morning we talked about risks and opportunities, and so I think this is the place where you'd also want to see a little bit more about opportunities rather than just the risk. And then in particular example on slide 15 in terms of types of risk, and this comes into the coherence thing, depending on where or not you put the resources and relationships, whether they're part of the business model or not, it's still probably worthwhile directly drawing out that both availability and affordability of your resources and relationships has to be a key risk. It needs to be discussed somewhere.
Yes, I think that would be helpful, and I think to some extent answers the point Mark raised earlier about highlighting some of the TCFD type risks, because they would naturally fall into some of those buckets.
Rodrigo?
I have a comment on item A49. Do you really think it's necessary to include the breakdown between the different sources of risk? Because I think the preparers would tend to follow that kind of suggested breakdown, and the last, in some cases, the line between wrong strategy selection and changes in external environment is a little bit thin, and companies will tend to push everything towards external environment, not to talk about wrong strategy selection. So I think that I think that it's the list of possible sources is okay. I just don't think the itemization is actually necessary.
Yes, and perhaps we need to make that clearer then, because what we're seeking to do here is specify a way of thinking about different categories of risk to ensure that we get comprehensive disclosure, rather than asking for categorisation of risks within those areas, because, yes, one risk could fit in a number of buckets.
Massimo?
One comment, actually two comments on slide 15 about the selection of the risks. I think it was already mentioned that removing the notion of principal risks was intended to provide more clarity on whether selected. However, I think at this stage we have, say, two notions which are unclear instead of one notion being principal risks. So perhaps one way to making it clearer is to clarify the time horizon over which risks should be reported and over which they are relevant. One other thing that could be helpful is to require that the risks reported should be corroborated by other elements in the management commentary. Because at the moment we have this reference to the fact that risks may arise from business model, strategy, etc., but it's not sort of requirement that says if you report some risks, they should not pop up in the risk reporting section. They should refer to other things that you are actively talking about. Otherwise, it becomes a bit disconnected from the rest. And I understand one of the objective of the risk reporting is to report the impact of risks on the entity's future net cash inflows. And again, if we modify that notion towards more value creation, I guess the scope of the risk reporting will be potentially different from just focusing on cash inflows.
One just tiny follow-up comment because of the categorization sort of observation. When we have conversations with companies, one way that actually often comes up is risks that the company or management team believes that they can control and risks that they think that they cannot really control. Trade wars, oh, big risk, but we can't do anything about it. Operational that we can. And again, so the risk that they think they can mitigate, not necessarily to zero, but mitigate, and risk that they can't. And a lot of it, sometimes you have the stuff out of control, but then a lot of it then is on the stuff that you can control because you can do things about them. And then there's sometimes this an interesting element, and it came up with maybe climate, other things, which risks that maybe some people think you can mitigate, but the company is choosing not to. Climate would be the touch point one, but actually there's others. So when management are actually saying, oh, we don't think this is a risk we can control, or we don't think this is a risk we can mitigate, but investors go, well, maybe we think you can. And because and actually that's the same conversation with opportunities. Some opportunities are within your control, and you're deciding to pursue it or not pursue it. And then you have an interesting, and it ties into strategy, of course, and that. Then you have an interesting conversation, like, oh, but your competition is, or we feel it would be positive for net cash flows in the future, but you're opting not to because you've got a resource thing. So that is in practical terms how a lot of the conversation goes to, which tends not to have been reflected in standard setter language. And again, so when business heads talk about their stuff, they'll spend a lot of time on the stuff they can do something about and tend to spend little time on the stuff they can't do anything about because of its nature is, well, we can't do anything about it, so we can talk about it a little bit, but and maybe we can mitigate some of it, but it's either going to happen or not happen, so we've got to get on with our business. And that's why some, at least business unit people, get somewhat frustrated with some of this other stuff, because it's like, talk to us about the stuff which is in our control. And then actually that ties a little bit into the incentives, because and as although complicated, they would prefer to be incentivized for stuff which is in their control and they can manage, and less incentivized to the stuff which is just outside of their control, because who wants to be paid for luck? Either way, actually, they don't like to be paid for good luck as well as bad luck.
I really hate that distinction.
Right, but between control or not control.
As a manager of a company, your job is also to manage things that are outside your control.
Yeah, although they can mitigate those. True.
And it is often abused to get remuneration up.
But then that's very interesting to have management articulate what they believe is out of their control, and then you can come after them for it.
Even a trade war, which may be completely out of your control, you still have to manage your company.
Yeah, no, true.
And the company will have to react to it, may have to lower its prices.
And if you're Goldman Sachs, you probably do have a lot of influence on how that comes out.
Massimo.
Yeah, on slide 8... I welcome the word opportunities in A42. I think we should be more bold on the opportunities side. Link on what you said earlier. I see maybe a missing point here on the trends and mega trends and these factors, and in particular on how the company is managing these factors. Which I think is important, not always possible, but this is also connected with slide 14, when you are asking how the risks are managed. So I would appreciate to have the management perspective also in slide 8. And finally, in slide 14, I think this is a quite interesting example on how cross-reference can work, specifically in financial services, where the risk disclosure is very big. So here you can provide the most material and relevant information and then link with the risk report.
Yes. Okay. Any other comments? Are we done?
This is outside my control, but we managed to...
You could admit it. Well, opportunity.
Okay, well, thank you very much. I think
good set of discussions.
Yes, extremely helpful. Thank you. And have a safe trip home.
Thank you.